brethren in Christ and those who have come this evening to find that love which only Christ can offer them. I left Germany, my home, full of anticipation and perhaps rather worried unnecessarily, and I flew like God's sparrow over that great duck pond which divides us, and I landed here in Gadsden, Alabama, and immediately I found myself just 100% at home. It was as if there was no duck pond between us, and I'm very, very happy to be with you and to fellowship with you as your brother in Christ, and no stranger, no foreigner, but a member with you in God's precious family. And I'd like to speak to you this evening about Anne Bradstreet. And I was going to call her the poet of the Puritans, but I think it would be better to call her the poet of purity. And Anne Bradstreet lived from 1612 to 1672. Now, she was a poet who helped you to find goodness, not just to feel good. It is an ancient maxim in literary criticism that all poets are liars, and poetry provides an escape from the humdrum reality of life into the fantasies of never, never land. Such critics have obviously not studied Anne Bradstreet, who ranks with Milton, Herbert, and Cooper as a poet of pure joy in contemplating God's amazing grace vouchsafed to believers in order to combat the lies and errors of fallen mankind. Few poets are as uplifting as Anne Bradstreet, because few poets have encountered and shared in spiritual truths as much as she. Thus, Puritan John Norton is not exaggerating in the least when he says that if Virgil had been privileged to read the seraphic poems of Anne Bradstreet, he would have committed his own efforts in soul harmony to the flames. Anne Bradstreet had the one thing needed to fit a human poet out for the divine task of speaking the unfallen language of Eden. This writer can heartily recommend his readers and hearers who are longing for God to curl up in a corner in a moment of prayerful relaxation with a volume of Bradstreet's in their hands. They will soon find themselves thinking, "It is good to be here." As this sweet, hard-working mother of 8 children describes her amazement at God's revelation to her in His Word. As Anne Bradstreet shares her husband, children, adopted grandchildren, and household chores with the Lord, she points to the goodness which is found solely in Christ, whoever says, "Cast your burden upon me, and I shall sustain you." Now, Anne Dudley was an offspring of Reformation pioneers. She was the daughter and the offspring of the famous Dudleys, who had played such a great role in the history of the English Reformation and Elizabethan settlement. Her father, Thomas Dudley, was a sincere believer and had captained a company of 80 volunteers in the Protestant wars on the continent. Thereafter, he became steward to Theophilus, the Earl of Lincoln, and the close friend of John Cotton, one of America's earliest and greatest Christian pioneers. Thomas was married to Dorothy, described as a gentle woman of good family and estate. Anne was born in Northampton, England, around 1612, and early took a stand for Christ and was thrilled with the stories of the opportunities given Christians in the New World. She had the best tutor and mentor humanly possible in her father. Thomas Dudley was a brilliant scholar and lover of edifying literature, history, and poetry. Cotton Mather, in his multifaceted history of North America, writes of Anne's father, "In books, a prodigal, they say, a living cyclopedia of histories of church and priest, a full compendium, at least, a table talker rich in sense and witty without wit's pretense." Thomas Dudley put his own affairs into the capable hands of Simon Bradstreet, son of a Puritan Lincolnshire minister. Simon was only a child when his father died, and so Thomas Dudley took care of him and trained him both in the ways of the Lord and in business and land management. When Anne was 16 years of age, Simon, 9 years her senior, proposed to her and was accepted. Anne was then struck down with smallpox and faced with the prospect of losing her great beauty and possibly her betrothed through ugly scars. She turned to the Lord in agony. Anne later confessed sadly and humbly, "When I was in my afflictions, I besought the Lord and confessed my pride and vanity. And he was entreated of me, and again restored me, but I rendered not to him according to the benefit received." Now, true love, whose course ran smooth. On Anne's recovery, the couple were wed, and embarked on a life of deep love and mutual understanding. And it was through her most romantic and spirit-filled marriage that Anne first took up her pen to praise God in poetry, composing "To My Dear and Loving Husband." "If ever two were one, then surely we. If ever man were loved by wife, then thee. If ever wife was happy in a man, compare with me, ye women, if you can. I prize thy love more than whole mines of gold, or all the riches that the east doth hold. My love is such that rivers cannot quench, nor aught but love from thee give recompense. Thy love is such I can no way repay. The heavens reward thee manifold, I pray. Then while we live in love, let's so persever that when we live no more, we may live ever." Persever is the old pronunciation of persevere, which in the old days rhymed with ever. Persever, ever. Shortly after their marriage in 1630, Anne and Simon joined Thomas and Dorothy Dudley and their friend John Winthrop and sailed in the Arabella to set up a plantation colony along the coast of Massachusetts Bay. Winthrop was appointed governor, Dudley deputy governor, and Bradstreet chief administrator. Dudley was to succeed Winthrop as governor in 1634, and he also became the colony's first major general. He in turn was succeeded by Simon Bradstreet, Anne's husband, but this was after Anne's death. The journey to the New World was a terrible ordeal. I just flew over that duck pond in comfort, but that sea voyage was horrible in those days, and took weeks and weeks. storms accompanied the vessel almost all the way. Scurvy broke out, and many pilgrims died. When land was reached at Charleston and tents set up, bad weather, lack of food, and continued attacks of scurvy plagued the colonialists. The death toll reached all families, and over 100 previous settlers decided that they had had enough and returned dejected to England on the Arabella. Even Dudley, disappointed but not beaten by a long way, wrote to England complaining that all the talk about the new promised land had been greatly exaggerated. There must, however, have been some pleasant moments in the long journey to the new world. Times of grace when the sun shone and hopes were raised. Thinking of such times and their temptations, Mrs. Bradstreet wrote later to advise Simon, her son. He that is to sail into a far country, although the ship, cabin, and provisions be all convenient and comfortable for him, yet he hath no desire to make that his place of residence, but longs to put in at that port where his business lies. A Christian is sailing through this world unto his heavenly country, and here he hath many conveniences and comforts, but he must beware of desiring to make this his place of abode, lest he should meet with such tossings that may cause him to long for shore before he sees land. We must therefore be here as strangers and pilgrims, that we may plainly declare that we seek a city above, and wait all the days of our appointed time till our change shall come. Excuse me, getting very dry. Now, Anne's life torn between two worlds. Anne was repulsed at the new world at first, but with her husband and her parents, she could not believe that God had deserted them. They pressed on, living from hand to mouth, and helped constitute a new congregation at Boston. Yet they still talked of our Britain, though realizing that they were perhaps cut off from old friends and relations for the rest of their lives. Anne, however, was struck down by a serious illness for the second time and became paralyzed in all her joints. By now, however, she had grown very much in grace and merely said of her great infirmities, "I fell into a lingering sickness like a consumption, together with lameness, which correction I saw the Lord sent to humble and try me and do me good, and it was not altogether ineffectual." Both Simon and Anne were very industrious, and despite ill health, soon had a fine house built and prosperous affairs to manage. Anne's husband was appointed secretary of the Colony's Company and Commissioner of the United Colonies. Though Anne was often ill, she managed to bear and raise a large family so that one day she could thankfully write, "I had 8 birds hatched in the nest. 4 cocks there were, and hens the rest. I nursed them up with pain and care, for cost nor labour did I spare, till at the last they felt their wing, mounted the trees, and learnt to sing." Anne Bradstreet's affections for England often troubled her, as, though she praised the faith of the new militant Puritans under Cromwell, she was compelled to condemn their politics and attitude to other believers. In her long poem, The Four Ages of Man, the Puritan lady looks back over her life from the failed Romanist attempt to kill James I and his entire parliament to to the foul murder of King Charles I, and writes, "I've seen from Rome an execrable thing, a plot to blow up nobles and their king. I've seen designs at Rue and Cades crossed, and poor Palatinate forever lost." Palatinate was the large reformed German province, which was lost to the Roman Catholics. "I've seen a prince to live on others' lands, a royal one by arms from subjects' hands. I've seen base men advance to great degree, and worthy ones put to extremity. But not their prince's love, nor state so high, could once reverse their shameful destiny. I've seen one stabbed, another lose his head, and others fly their country through their dread. I've seen, and so have ye, for 'tis but late, the desolation of a godly state, plotted and acted so that none can tell who gave the counsel but the Prince of Hell." That was Anne Bradstreet's comment on the Cromwell regime. Thinking of the golden age of the church in Elizabeth's reign, she could write, "But happy England, which had such a queen. Oh, happy, happy had those days still been." Now for more trials and testing. Not only poor health caused Mrs. Bradstreet to grow closer to God, but many a material plight which would have caused others to ask why God had forsaken them. After building a spacious house for the large family, Mrs. Bradstreet was awakened one night by a terrible roar. A huge fire blazed around her, and she could hear the pitiful cries of her terrified children. All dashed out, but no worldly goods could be saved. The fire devastated every chair, table, and chest that they had possessed. Finding herself briefly cast down at this great loss, Mrs. Bradstreet quickly took heart and wrote, after describing the terrible scenes in her verses upon the burning of our house, "Then straight I gan my heart to chide, and did thy wealth on earth abide? Didst fix thy hope on mouldering dust? The arm of flesh didst make thy trust? Raise up thy thoughts above the sky, that dunghill mists away may fly. Thou hast an house on high erect, framed by that mighty architect, with glory richly furnished, stands permanent though this be fled. It's purchased and paid for too, by him who hath enough to do. A price so vast as is unknown, yet by his gift is made thine own. There's wealth enough, I need no more. Farewell my pelf, farewell my store. The world no longer let me love. My hope and treasure lie above." Anne had to go through times of great loneliness and longing, because her husband was always on the move, looking after the affairs of the colony. Simon Bradstreet's diligence promoted him regularly, and he climbed rapidly up the administrative and political ladder. He was now often away from home on diplomatic journeys or on tour through the colony as its faithful steward. At times, Anne Bradstreet was very lonely, in spite of her children, because she missed Simon dearly. Their honeymoon days never waned. However, Dudley had a large library, and amidst household chores, gardening, acting as sick nurse, and caring for a seemingly ever-growing crowd of children, Mrs. Bradstreet found time to read, learn, and inwardly digest the literary and spiritual treasures of her father. The history of Britain and the ancient East thrilled her, as did works on science and medicine. No student ever devoured such literary food as eagerly as Mrs. Bradstreet. Few students were so strengthened in spirit and instructed in mind by such a repast. Nevertheless, the periods of parting from her husband forced her to express her love for him in verse, as she followed him from place to place with her thoughts and prayers. Daily seeing her husband's looks and mannerisms in her children, Mrs. Bradstreet writes, "In this dead time, alas, what can I more than view those fruits which through thy heat I bore, which sweet contentment yields me for a space, true living pictures of their father's face. O strange effect, now thou art southward gone, I weary grow the tedious day so long. But when thou northward to me shalt return, I wish my sun would never set, but burn within the cancer of my glowing breast, the welcome house of him, my dearest guest. Wherever, ever stay, and go not thence, till nature's sad decree shall call thee hence. Flesh of my flesh, bone of thy bone, I here, thou there, yet both but one." Anne Bradstreet's mentors in literature and poetry would surprise and even shock those fuddy-duddies who believe blindly that the early American Puritans had no thought for beauty in either expression or art, no longing for the romantic, but an unholy fear of expressing emotion. They weren't like that at all. Mrs. Bradstreet's favourite reading was the work of Sir Philip Sidney, one of my childhood heroes, but so often denigrated by modern would-be Puritans for writing about human love in its reflection of divine affection. This sadly is also the lot of John Donne, whose love poetry opens many windows to heaven. Even Anne Bradstreet's biographer, James Anderson, who often eulogizes his subject, has no sympathy for her when she writes of the great French soldier poet Du Bartas, "Amongst the happy wits this age hath shown, great, dear, sweet Bartas, thou art matchless known." Excuse me. Oh, it'd be all right there, thank you. Now Anne Bradstreet becomes a public figure. Anne Bradstreet had written her poetry as an expression of the secret feelings of her heart, and had no intention of making them public. Though, in 1642, she did distribute a number amongst her family with a dedication to her father, concluding it with the words, "From her that to yourself more duty owes than waters in the boundless ocean flows." However, John Woodbridge, a minister married to Mrs. Bradstreet's sister Mercy, copied and collected Anne's poems as secretly as she wrote them. On travelling to London in 1650, he had them published, and even wrote in a preface that his sister-in-law had no idea what he was doing, and would have forbidden him if she had known. Woodbridge's lame excuse was that if he did not publish his sister-in-law's verse, someone else would, and thus make a worse job of it. Though we must chide the over-enthusiastic minister for his indiscretion, Anne Bradstreet's poetry became a bestseller in Britain, and proved a means of great blessing to many. Here was a woman of deep faith and high learning who used the vehicle of poetry, so often discredited by worldly scribblers in rhyme, to reveal what is honest, true, pure, lovely, and edifying to the reader, and honouring to God. Though now a public figure, Mrs. Bradstreet did not change her way of life one bit. Now, something about Mrs. Bradstreet's prose and her famous book, Meditations. Anne Bradstreet is mostly remembered for her poems of experience, yet she was a master of prose, though little of it has been preserved. Simon, her son, asked his mother to leave him a greater inheritance than wealth at her death, indicating that he wished her to draw together all the good advice she had given him as a child and young man. The result was Mrs. Bradstreet's Meditations, compiled from her own writings and put together during March 1664. The work is a box of precious jewels. Here are but a few of them. The finest bread hath the least bran, the purest honey the least wax, and the sincerest Christian the least self-love. Downy beds make drowsy persons, but hard lodging keeps the eyes open. A prosperous state makes a secure Christian, but adversity makes him consider. Diverse children have their different natures. Some are like flesh, which nothing but salt will keep from putrefaction. Some again like tender fruits that are best preserved with sugar. Those parents are wise that can fit the nurture according to their nature. A low man can go upright under a door, where a taller is glad to stoop. So a man of weak faith and mean abilities may undergo a cross more patiently than he that excels him in gifts and graces. Few men are so humble as not to be proud of their abilities, and nothing will abase them more than this. What hast thou but what thou hast received? Come, give an account of thy stewardship. Iron, till it be thoroughly heated, is incapable to be wrought. So God sees good to cast some men into the furnace of affliction, and then beats them on his anvil into what frame he pleases. That town, which thousands of enemies without have not been able to take, hath been delivered up by one traitor within. And that man, which all the temptations of Satan without could not hurt, hath been foiled by one lust within. God hath by his providence so ordered that no one country hath all the commodities within itself, but what it wants another shall supply, that so there may be a mutual commerce through the world. As it is with countries, so it is with men. There was never yet any one man that had all excellencies. Let his parts, natural and acquired, spiritual and moral, be never so large, yet he stands in need of something which another man hath, perhaps meaner than himself, which shows us perfection is not below, as also that God will have us beholden one to another. Now, finally, the weary pilgrim rests in peace. Shortly after becoming well known in both the old and new worlds, Mrs. Bradstreet, seldom a healthy woman, became terminally ill with tuberculosis. When her daughter, Dorothy Cotton, married to Seaborn, John Cotton's son, died, rather than allow this to increase her sorrow, Mrs. Bradstreet rejoiced to know that she would soon join her in their father's mansion. Viewing death with fearless faith, and looking back over all the harsh hardships her family had endured through God's grace in the past, Anne Bradstreet continued her poem, "The Weary Pilgrim, Now at Rest," with the words, "A pilgrim I on earth, perplexed with sins, with cares, and sorrows vexed, my age and pain brought to decay, by age and pain brought to decay, and my clay house mouldering away, oh, how I long to be at rest, and soar on high amongst the blessed. This body shall in silence sleep, mine eyes no more shall ever weep, no fainting fits shall me assail, nor grinding pains my body frail, with cares and fears ne'er cumbered be, nor losses know, nor sorrows see. What though my flesh shall there consume, it is the bed Christ did perfume. And when a few years shall be gone, this mortal shall be clothed upon, a corrupt carcass down it lies, a glorious body it shall rise, in weakness and dishonor sown, in power 'tis raised by Christ alone. Then soul and body shall unite, and of their Maker have the sight, such lasting joy shall there behold, as ear ne'er heard, as ear ne'er heard, nor tongues e'er told. Lord, make me ready for the day, then come, dear bridegroom, come away." Simon, now a qualified physician, realized that his mother, though only 60 years of age, had run her course, and her goal was in sight. Though but skin and bone, and in great pain due to the merciless illness, Anne Bradstreet remained in full assurance of faith, and was more concerned in comforting her dear ones than feeling any need for comfort herself. When her eyelids closed in death, Simon wrote, "Oh, that the Lord would give me and mine a heart to walk in her steps," considering what the end of her conversation was, "that so we might one day have a happy and glorious greeting." Throughout her poetry, Anne Bradstreet had always been fascinated by the interplay of eternity on time. The closing words of her long poem, "Contemplations on the Death and Burial of a Christian," serve as a fitting epitaph to her own eternal life, always longing, whilst in her time span, to be freed from her earthly burden. "O time, thou fatal rack of mortal things, that draws oblivion's curtains over kings, their sumptuous monuments, men know them not, their names without a record are forgot, their parts, their ports, their pomps, all laid in the dust, nor wit, nor gold, nor buildings 'scape time's rust. But he whose name is gravered in the white stone shall last and shine when all of these are gone." Anne Bradstreet has certainly a message for today and for every day. John Fiske, in his important and oft-praised work, The Beginnings of New England, or The Puritan Theocracy in Its Relation to Civil and Religious Liberty, pulling, as it were, a drawer out of the cupboard of history, briefly says of Anne Bradstreet that she was a woman of quaint learning and quainter verse, which her contemporaries admired beyond measure. He then shuts the drawer and continues in his praise of Mrs. Bradstreet's husband, after telling his readers that Anne Bradstreet merely inherited her gifts from her father. Thus, the greatest poet the English Puritan colonies ever produced, and one of their finest illustrations of faith, triumphing over every human difficulty, is squeezed as a tiny aside into an account relating the political feats of two men who had so much relied and built on Anne Bradstreet's faith, comfort, and Christian exhortation. Both Thomas Dudley and Simon Bradstreet certainly would not have been the men they were if Anne Bradstreet had not been the woman she was. Far more objective is Cotton Mather in his insistence that whatever Dudley's merits, his daughter was his crown, and her poetry a monument of her for her memory beyond the stateliest marbles. Mather also reminds men who believe that their sex monopolizes the muses that they have due cause to blush with shame when faced with Mrs. Bradstreet's accomplishments. He then joins Benjamin Woodbridge, the first graduate of Harvard, in putting such men in their place. In your own arts, confess yourselves outdone. The moon hath totally eclipsed the sun, not with her sable mantle muffling him, but her bright silver makes his gold look dim. Sadly, our school history books paint a sable-mantled, muffled picture of their imagined dark and dismal Puritans, depicting them as a fog-covered sun set to rise no more. How necessary it is to balance this artificial picture with Mrs. Bradstreet's brave, colourful, cheerful, entertaining and uplifting verse. Her words, reflecting her experience of life, give a true and lasting picture of the spirit of Puritan men and women who sought to build heaven on earth against great odds. Her never-dying verse, reflecting her deep taste of God's eternal love, is still fully equipped to lead and accompany modern mankind on the way to heavenly bliss. It is a great pity indeed that her complete works are scarcely known and have not been reprinted for generations. May her memory not be allowed to die in her bodily death, but be kept ever living amongst us until we meet her face to face in glory. So be it. Thank you.
Brother George told me when I picked him up at the airport yesterday that he had not spoken English on a daily basis in over 40 years. And he apologized for being rusty. And a few words, just a few tonight that he had to repeat. I think he did exceptionally well. He has been in conversation since he's been here. Would you be willing to entertain questions?
Yes. Okay. All right. Shall I? I wasn't expecting any, but
I understand. And if you don't have enough strength, that would be understandable. But if anyone, I'm sure some of the sisters may have some questions, and brothers too.
Oh, I must apologize for my weakness. I'm still suffering under jet lag and other things. Feeling rather tired, but shoot away. Perhaps I might even have some answers.
Would you repeat the question for the sake of the recording, please?
Yes, right. Oh, I didn't realize I was being recorded.
Why her work had not been published?
Yes, why have Anne Bradstreet's works not been published for generations? Well, I think the plain truth is that her message is not welcome. Here we have a mother of 8 children virtually slaving away in her household, but producing such wonderful literature, and she doesn't fit in with the modern picture of a rather worldly career woman. And motherhood is seen nowadays, unfortunately, as a sort of second career. And people aren't as interested in the gospel as they were in those days. I said she had the one thing needed. Well, this one thing is more needed today than ever. And if these people could have the patience and understanding and the motives to read Anne Bradstreet, they too would experience this one thing needed. Mm-hmm. Oh, don't be as shy as I am. I'm doing what I'm leaning. There are 2 people who look as though they're going to ask questions. Oh, well, Anne Bradstreet is my theme tonight, not George Eller. Yes. Oh, excuse me, I couldn't answer that one. Yes, oh, there's the lady first and then the gentleman in front. Is it? Sorry, I didn't catch. Oh yes, they're extremely difficult, and that's why I believe that some Christian ought to reprint those works. I don't know what your own connections are, but in that field, but I have the interest in doing that, but not the. The financial capacity or the means of popularizing such a work. I think it should be done by a younger person full of energy and full of the love of Christian poetry and full of evangelistic zeal, and also one who has the financial ability to reprint such a book, but with supply publications by demand today, the possibilities are there, because you just send a disc to the printer and you phone him and say, well, I want 2 copies or I want 3, and then a few weeks later when the demand comes, I want 3 more. And in this way, perhaps private people on low income could finance such a project. Sir?
This is a historical question in, you said that she supported, or that she looked back fondly on Elizabeth I.
Yes.
And that she did not sound like that she supported the Puritans in the English Civil War against the British royalists.
No, she didn't. Okay. She didn't. The picture of the Civil War, or the Great Rebellion, or the Usurpation, as it used to be called, has altered radically since those days. The general, after the Restitution, the general idea was that Charles I had died a Christian martyr, and that Cromwell had more or less usurped the government. And then in the 19th century, there was a growth of Presbyterianism, and there was a new look at the problem, and new theories were developed. I myself am fully of Anne Bradstreet's persuasion, and I am reading now all the Westminster minutes, which have never been published, and there are four volumes of them in the Ryland, John Ryland Library in Manchester, and some of us are hoping to publish them, but they do show a rather dark well, they do tell a rather dark story. That's my own humble opinion. When Charles I died, he wrote a book called, just before he died in prison, he wrote a book called The King's Sighs. And there he expressed his thoroughly reformed faith and prayers for his executioners. And this became a bestseller amongst the Puritans. And this led eventually to the restitution, or the coming back of Charles II. But Charles II didn't win the support that people would have liked, and so the revolution continued throughout his reign. He wanted a union between the Anglicans and the Presbyterians, but certain political forces were not interested. And there was the Monmouth Rebellion and things like that. You're nodding, so you know all about that. So any more questions? Yes, sir.
You said that once her works were published, in England and in the colonies, were there other writers, poets in the colonies during that time to kind of overshadow her?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm biased. I think she was the first among many, and just as the first hasn't been really acclaimed as she should be, the many haven't been acclaimed at all. But of course, Cotton Mather was also a poet, and Increase and Nathaniel and Cotton Mather, they were great men of literature. Cotton Mather could write in half a dozen languages, and did do and publish many books, children's books too, even books of funny stories. So there were writers. Of course, Jonathan Edwards too started when he was in his teens, some people say earlier, and wrote great works. But poetry, I think we'll have to wait until Whittier, who not all would accept as a Christian poet, but then a Longfellow and people like that, but their days were still to come.
So you are correct idea of Puritanism as being stark and dreary with another view.
Oh yes. There were different kinds of Puritans, and the English Puritans tended to be more poetically, more literary, more musically minded than the very staunch the Scottish Presbyterians. But you see, the Presbyterians in Scotland, they believed they were suffering under a foreign power. And so their opposition was really greater than the English Puritans. And most of the English Puritans left Presbyterianism anyway, and they became independents or returned to the Anglican fold. But before the Revolution, there were more Anglican Puritans, really, than Presbyterian or independent Puritans. But we forget that because Cromwell has become so famous, and we believe these stories that Charles I was so evil and Cromwell was so good, but that's a black and white picture that can't stand the test of history at all. And to me, as a Christian, revolution is the last possible thing that a Christian should be thinking of. Sorry, I don't want to get into politics.
Who would have been some of the theologians that influenced Anne Bradstreet in particular? Do you have any idea?
Oh yes, John Cotton and the Mathers, most definitely. And Perkins, she doesn't talk about Perkins as far as I remember, but the ideas behind her. And she was obviously very much reformed in her theology. But America at that time had a great many very, very good theologians. They started off amongst the Presbyterians, but gradually the American colonies became more and more under the independents, and they were far more tolerant than the Presbyterians. Thomas Goodwin, for example, was a great independent Puritan. And some of the old English Anglican Puritans, like Hall, were still alive. And Featley died in prison, but he was the greatest theologian of his day. And when the Presbyterians wanted to defend themselves against the Roman Catholics, they went to Featley's prison cell and asked him to write a defense. But because he was a prisoner, they would only allow him 3 books at a time to do his research on, and then he produced his great defense against the Roman Catholic Church whilst in prison, and in prison he died. And he died because he was a member of the Church of England and a supporter of King Charles, but not in a political way. Oh, those were terrible times.
The accomplishment of Anne having so many children and so many domestic duties seem amazing that she could have such an education. Do you think that she, because of her station, did she have nursemaids and assistants? And, you know, we've seen examples in Charleston, South Carolina, where a lady had a number of children, but she had one nurse for every child.
Oh, that's not the case with Anne Bradstreet. At the beginning, they had to build their houses themselves, and they had to tend the crops, look after the animals, And I'm sure that there were some kind-hearted women who supported her, because that was a very tightly committed church. You see, the people were going to the Promised Land, and they were full of the joys of the Lord, and they were prepared to experience all these hardships, and they pulled together. So you didn't really build your own house. The whole community came and helped you. So, of course, wherever Anne Bradstreet would have been with her 8 children, they'd have been kind-hearted ladies helping her. But she doesn't seem to have had, you know, a nursemaid for each child and a cook and bottle washer and everything like that. Not at all. They although they were the governing families, they seem to have led very humble lives and very hard-working lives. Yes, sorry. I think Anne Bradstreet's children could never take care of themselves. They were so, they loved their mum so well, and she was so much wiser than they. So, especially Simon too, until her death, they were her tiny tots. She had had several children then. The family ties in the Bradstreet family were very tight, and they had a wonderful family experience.
Did she recover from the paralysis?
Oh, yes. Yes, she did. But then the tuberculosis set in. She did. She recovered from the smallpox. She had no scars. She was still as beautiful as ever. And she recovered from the lameness too. Mm. So she had experienced 9 miracles in her life. Mm. Well, I'll be here for another 2 weeks. Mm. Shall we?